Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Nichelle De Silva, and I am delighted to be joined by Daniel A. Barber, who is an Associate Professor of Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania Weitzman School of Design. We'll be talking about his book, Modern Architecture and Climate, Design Before Air Conditioning, published by Princeton University Press in 2020. Welcome, Daniel. And thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Could you begin by telling us a bit about yourself and your background, particularly how you came to your longstanding research interests around climate and architecture?
Sure. Yeah. No, it's a great question, and it's a nice way to kind of start it off. I sort of came to the discussion of architecture from the direction, from environmentalism, if you will. I mean, from a kind of, which is to say not specifically, I wasn't trained as an architect. I grew up around architecture. My father is an architect. And I was in effect trained as an artist and also in history and theory. My undergraduate program at the University of Washington was called the Comparative History of Ideas. And it was one of these sort of, develop your own field of study sort of majors. And so there was a lot of thought about the built environment and how it related to social practices and the kind of, the sort of interface between what we used to think of as nature, right, and what we used to think of as culture. So I kind of came to the question of architecture really from the ambition that this was a sort of space to sort of think about and use to mediate and think through questions around the environment and its changing relationship to social processes. And, we could see how much we want to get into this sort of discussion, but, in a sense was kind of surprised when I sort of came into the field and around 2000 where the discussion was, where architecture was kind of seeing itself in relationship to the environment. And from that kind of shock and sort of some dismay, I just kind of dove into the archives, in effect, and started to root around and find other sorts of, kind of origins of architecture and environmentalism. And so the first book that I wrote that was on solar houses in the mostly American context in the 1940s and 50s started to tell that story and to kind of interweave narratives of architecture and energy habits and practices, kind of ways of living in the territory. So sort of ways of territorial living, like ways of being in the environment, right? And in a funny way, it's all very close to me. I mean, this book, as we'll get into, departs from some of that a bit, but I growing up in Colorado in the 1970s and 80s, there were solar houses everywhere. And my father, was an architect of many things. I mean, he was very much there to be making a living and did malls and casinos and houses and dentist offices and, the gamut. But nonetheless, I was attuned to the kind of solar developments around us and the houses that we, lived in and played in. We're kind of aware of their natural environment, right? So in some ways, I'm, writing about my own history when I'm writing these books.
Yes, it does seem in some ways as though this book is a bit of a prequel to, well, prequel in some ways, but then flows very nicely into your second book. In this current book, I was really quite compelled by the way you describe the building facade as a media device and the way in which the variability of the facade becomes a media event. And there's a lot going on in this very compelling claim. And I really want to unpack this idea that runs through your book through a few questions in this first part of the interview. So I want to start with the facade itself, which, as you say, mediates between the interior of a building and the exterior environment, but also, as you point out, functions as an epochal marker. And that was really interesting to me because the term modern architecture is such a fraught one. And while concern with the formal is a relatively recent phenomenon, it seems to have become really perniciously pervasive in schools of architecture. And I really love that you resist this and you instead examine this relationship between architecture and climate and make that central to your book. And this sort of, you open this with your discussion of the glass facade in Le Corbusier's work in chapter one. Could you talk about what this means in terms of how you frame architecture and climate? What does this mean for how we understand not only Le Corbusier's work, but how we interpret modern architecture as a concept?
Yeah, great. Thank you. I mean, such a thoughtful question. It's so nice to to have the book engaged at such a helpful level. And it is really an important aspect of it. I mean, I think that trying to sort of model and understand how to, in a sense, how climate was a part of the discussion of modern strategies in the 20s and 30s, right? The development of Le Corbusier is complex, and certainly one easily kind of steps into it relative to such a well-known figure. But there's a clear strain in the archive. I mean, a clear thread, a kind of river that one can see kind of flowing at wider and thinner throughout his work, especially before World War II, that focuses on climate, right? And that thinks about the building in relationship to climate on technical terms, working with engineers, and there's an air conditioning side to this, and there's a kind of solar incidents and brise soleil side to it, right? And he's which is to say, in part, that there's just a sort of general recognition that the management of the thermal interior was essential to Le Corbusier's practice on sort of that in that basic way, but also to the imagination of the modern movement, right? And so what I do in the first part of the book, and through Le Corbusier and kind of starting with him and taking it to developments that are often seen to be in Le Corbusier's shadow in Brazil. And one of the sort of points that I try to make, over that span of the first few chapters is that really the kind of interesting work is happening in these other spaces and spaces that had been othered, in fact, in that historical context, and really sort of going from south to north, and knowledge moving in all sorts of directions, right, rather than a sort of unitary fashion. So there's there's a couple of things going on there, right? There's a sort of claim that says that modernism relied on a climatic argument, in a sense, right? And modern architecture, as it imagined itself and argued for itself and attempted to build in various places around the world, especially in the so-called tropical or zones or the areas of in the industrializing South, right, in the 40s and 50s, that being able to make an argument for an ability to sort of modulate the thermal interior was an important way that architecture would be built in Brazil, in Nigeria, across India, and many other places. I mean, we're not going to there's no efficacy in sort of playing out the list, but there's, at the same time, there's a clear concentration in Brazil and in West Africa and indeed in the Indian subcontinent. So starting to sort of understand how essential climatic management, however misapprehended, I mean, however much some of these ideas didn't work or were sort of, one thinks of much of the work of Le Corbusier in India and its sort of climatic misapprehensions. But nonetheless, the ambitions were there and the sort of argument was there. So it's in part to say, right, that climate was an essential component of the development of the modern movement, right? That modernism was really conceived of in its material components of steel, glass, and concrete, and in its sort of, you know, sociocultural capacities for engagement and intervention into new spaces around the world, you know, be they colonial and neocolonial, developmental, or, you know, other forms of kind of economic and social practices that were, you know, obviously associated with these architectural ideas in their details and on those general terms. But there's a real, yeah, there's a clear sort of thread that says that the sort of positioning of these practices relative to their conception of a thermal space was essential to their development, right? So that's the kind of one basic premise, that relative to architecture and climate, that they kind of are argued together. I mean, I could go on to talk about the facade piece for a second, the kind of media and facade piece more specifically. Does that make sense to do? Yeah, just keep.
Yes.
Okay. So the other sort of important thread there that you also open up, how media becomes this sort of, and media considered both in the sense of objects and diagrams and drawings and graphs and charts and, you know, photographs, certainly architectural drawings of all sorts. Media become this sort of space of discourse, right? Not only for an architectural set of ideas, but indeed, architecture as a field, as a professional practice, is a sort of first place or important place where media that's trying to describe the climate, you know, starts to be circulated in. Which is beyond, that's to say, sort of those fields specifically concerned with climate, beyond meteorology, right? I mean, associated fields, right? One of the early attempts to kind of think about climate outside of its specific field of analysis. And so, media, you know, one of the sort of foundations of the book is the premise that media is required, is necessary to understand climate, right? The climate is an abstract concept that, you know, you walk outside and experience the weather. But if you want to understand climate, you need media. You need a sense of a range of time and space and what your parameters are and how those parameters, how the climate shifts over time is something that has to, you know, sort of be mapped out and represented in order to be understood. And quite similarly, you know, in order to really understand architecture, right, we need media and drawings and other, you know, familiar and unfamiliar forms of architectural representation. And it's that kind of intersection, right, where we see that this sort of question of architecture and media really plays out in the climatic context. This just proliferation, I mean, this wild proliferation of drawings, diagrams and sections and, you know, certainly perspectives and other sorts of illustrative images and photographs, of course, circulating as well. But just this sort of wild proliferation of a specific kind of technical image of technical media. And I sort of work with Willem Flusser here in the introduction to sort of think through this question of the technical image and how it, you know, comes to sort of offer certain modes of knowledge and, you know, this kind of notion that if we understand the diagram of the climatic condition in which a building sits, right? The sort of premise that will somehow encourage a different mode of practice. And so thinking about the instrumental or not components of the image as it's produced as well, it, as a sort of prelude to the continued proliferation of imagery around architecture and climate, right? I mean, in the past decade, of course, just another sort of flurry of activity in the media production of a kind of architectural approach to climate, right? So really seeing, you know, images and ideas and practices and charts and intersections and media as the sort of place where architecture associates with other fields and shares knowledge, and also as a place where it sort of produces, right, the built environment and obviously produces other types of knowledge as well, that to just sort of see that as a place where the climate, a cultural approach to climate is kind of produced, right? The way that we associate as a specific society or a sort of global society as well to the climatic environment outside is in very, very much sort of mediated, right? Determined, interfaced, affected by sort of rendered on our building facades, right? So the mediatic approach to a building is a way to kind of understand that facade is really sort of expressing a relationship, right? Expressing a form of interaction between social habits and global patterns of climatic global climatic patterns, right? So I look at the facade. I look at the facade section, and you know, it's something of a polemic. It's something of a just sort of kind of diving in as far as possible into the details to see how we can sort of then zoom out and kind of read something very specific about the world. But you know, trying to look at that facade section and how it kind of starts to become a very dynamic space. And the sections we're looking at are, you know, have multiple systems of shading and, you know, some that are fixed, some that are movable, some that, you know, adjust at different times of the day, and that really sort of script a form of interaction, right? And it's kind of induce, you know, cultivate, bring the body and the subject into a sort of interaction with their thermal environment, right? So it's there's another sort of argument there of kind of media and interfaces and kind of thinking about the relationship between the, let's say, the physicality and the virtual of the thermal spaces we inhabit today, and how we start to, in a sense, a history of how we've related to the climate of our interiors and its relationship to the exterior, that tries to understand these varying dimensions of habits and practices and technologies and designs and other methods, right? Of course, media encompassing all of those forms of knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. And it's been really interesting to read some of the ways in which some of your ideas that are developed in the book have also been extended into some of the editorial and other work you've done. You edited a series on efflux called Accumulations that then takes this idea that, you know, you really need some kind of media to try and understand what climate is. You know, like you say, you can experience the weather, but climate is sort of so abstract in some ways that you need a kind of media to even kind of begin to comprehend what it is. And I really like the way you very, you know, over the course of the book, take this idea of the facade section and think about it, not just, you know, the way it appears on the page, but also the way in which it becomes distributed. And so I actually want to move on to the second part of the interview, because I did have a few questions in this first part about the facade and on media and mediation, but I feel like you've answered many of them in this response. So I actually want to move on to, you know, another thing that really runs through your book, which is the question of normativity, of setting standards, of universals. And I really like how, you know, you use this Bernhard Siegert quote to sort of, you know, really emphasize that there's no such thing as the house. You know, we sort of imagine the sort of, you know, child's drawing, you know, four walls, two windows and a roof, but you really unsettle that. And, you know, you're sort of really taking seriously this idea that, you know, as Siegert says, there are only, and I quote, historically and culturally contingent cultural techniques of shielding oneself. And so you sort of look at how, you know, the cultural technique of the facade becomes deployed in service of climate control. And then, I mean, you have some really great quotes. So I'm actually going to quote this other Camusier quote as well. He says that, you know, when he's talking about modern architecture, he says, teach your children that architecture is about sunlight on floors. And it's such an interesting quote because it's not just, you know, the poetry of sunlight on floors, but, you know, the fact that it's prefaced with teach your children. So it's not just about what he thinks architecture should be, but that there's this pedagogical imperative that others should also be taught this, and it should be this sort of generational thing. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit, you know, you sort of talk about how these technical diagrams serve as an instrument of modernization. You talk about how architects become roving experts for setting these norms and the eventual export of a very specific American lifestyle that requires quite a lot of energy usage. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you see the pedagogical imperative of, you know, as you say, this paradox between trying to make a mode of shelter that is infinitely adaptive, but also trying to set a normative condition for, you know, these standards that people can live up to. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, this is, again, a great set of really fascinating points of connection. Let's see, kind of thinking where to start. I mean, I think, again, the sort of question of the house, and maybe starting with the Siegert quote, and, you know, part of what we start to realize, I mean, part of what the book tries to, you know, the kind of thread that I'm sort of pulling out of these various stories, really is a means to understand again the ways in which architecture can be framed as a sort of device of climatic adaptability, right? That the facade in particular and this sort of interface between, you know, interior and exterior and sort of, again, social habits and sort of global climates, right? That this is a sort of wildly variable set of operations and devices and materializations and sort of cultural practices, right? And so Siegert's really helpful in helping us to kind of, you know, think about it as a sort of set of cultural practices that can, you know, kind of take on so many forms, and that also is so expressive of sort of investments or, cultural sort of priorities and kind of even kind of capacities and forms of knowledge and kind of what we're sort of able to do in a given moment by virtue of the kind of cultural techniques that we're, as Siegert's term, that we're, you know, sort of managing and engaging with and to some extent kind of manipulating, right? So again, this sense of not the house as something that's, and quite frankly, in direct, positioning, contrary to the work of, you know, the kind of Heideggerian threads that persist in some mediatic and philosophical discussions, you know, to sort of resist this question of the kind of house dwelling kind of essential space in any fashion, and really just kind of document and record and understand and sort of trace this set of developments relative to the articulation of a certain type of shelter and a certain type of relationship between, again, yeah, the kind of thermal interior, right, and the global, the climatic exterior. How we can kind of manage and understand our thermal world, right? I mean, really the challenge of the book and the challenge of my, you know, sort of research in general, what I'm continuing to try to do is, you know, how can we explain, this is, also relative to the accumulation work and the kind of broader editorial practices. And I've also recently started a website, a sort of web platform with some colleagues that's called Current, that's kind of a space for talking about architecture and environment. So, you know, look this up and come join us. But to think about, you know, these sort of different practices as ways to really shift the way that we're imagining the production of our built environment today, right? And so, you know, there's a strong sort of scripting in the book and its argument from the, you know, introduction and you know, its various points of sort of framing and concluding that tries to really, you know, set this up as a challenge to practice. And I, you know, something, another sort of issue that I struggle with or that we discuss in our, you know, sort of disciplinary context, the kind of methodological discourses of the relative sort of instrumentality of historical knowledge, but sort of not wanting to resist the fact that the material being put on the table is sort of exceedingly relevant to contemporary practice, but also wanting to understand that relevance is not, you know, precisely operational, right? It's not to say architects need to kind of, many do already deploy these techniques, but also just to sort of think about how these kind of systems and interfaces and concepts that emerge from this, you know, trace of the facade and its elaboration as a climatic device and this kind of sense of architecture, again, as a sort of condition of adaptability, right? As a sort of means of reimagining these socio-energetic relationships, right? That gives us a kind of opportunity, I think, to think through possibilities for the future in compelling ways. So right. So there's a hope that's, I mean, in a sense, of course, it's even quite explicitly a sort of recognition of another kind of break, much as the one, you know, theorized and often criticized and sort of debunked relative to the sort of moment of modernism, right? So to think of Le Corbusier's quote, as you do, as you bring in, and this question of teacher children, you know, that I think is, yes, certainly pedagogical and also sort of speculative, right? That this is always about the kind of how things should be in the future. And you know, the future is the relationship of modernism to the future. And when we kind of bring climate change into that discussion, you know, it gets really complicated, right? Because the futures that we imagined have been overwhelmed by the, you know, carbon that we've produced, basically, right? I mean, we have foreclosed on many dreams and fantasies of kind of modernist progressivism, in part through the production of the heavily, you know, mechanically acclimatized built environment. So I think there's a really, you know, I mean, without getting too much into kind of playing out again this discourse through Le Corbusier, because I want to jump on to another part of your question, but I think that question of the future and pedagogy and speculation really gets sort of caught up in a kind of attempt to reflect on how the kind of progressive principles embedded in the modern movement were reliant upon a petroculture and a kind of a premise of unmitigated oil and energy use. I mean, I've written elsewhere about the extent to which the Bauhaus Dessau building was, you know, a sort of experiment in excessive coal use, right? I mean, it just becomes the Seagram's Tower in New York, just this kind of, how can we use as much energy as possible, right? Becomes the kind of project of modern architecture in some sense. So how are we, you know, how are we seeing buildings again as these kind of, you know, practices and systems and technologies and assemblages and objects and that we're in interacting with in the context of our kind of thermal being, right? I mean, our carbon output, our kind of energetic condition, right, is sort of expressed through the architectural facade. Even today, I mean, of course, you know, part of the reason to make this argument about the heavily shading deviced facade, right? The kind of device of climatic adaptability that I, of course, have mentioned already and play out at great length, right? Part of the reason to sort of clarify the dynamism of that interactive facade system of the sort of early modern discussions, and especially in Brazil, right, as I discuss in the first part of the book, is to note that the facade section soon becomes that of a kind of, you know, curtain wall, basically a thin sheath of glass that is sort of kind of a sheath around the building that is more or less sealed, more or less requiring a strong set of internal conditioning mechanical systems that will provide heat and cooling and ventilation. So in effect, a sort of arc of the book that describes how the kind of knowledge that began to be produced through these elaborations of a wide range of, you know, design and interventions and facade, dynamic facade shading systems, and even different sorts of materials conditions and all sorts of architectural questions, right? If you will, I mean, in a sort of capital A sort of way, as they were imagined, right, kind of endemic to the field, right, rather than external to it, that discourse around architecture and climate as sort of part of what architecture is, at some point, well, at a precise point in 1959, right, becomes a discourse, you know, that sort of idea of the comfort zone and the kind of capacity, how we live in the thermal interior, gets subsumed by the logic of air conditioning, right? And the kind of regulatory system of the universal standards of ASHRAE, the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers, but that in 59 becomes a sort of global entity and starts to advise and consult and kind of have as its project to internationalize, right? And sort of produce a global standard. And so the second half of the book, as you sort of allude to, which is called the American acceleration, right, is a sort of argument that this model that emerges, again, initially a conceptual model of a thermal interior that emerges through media, through diagrams, through interactions with other fields as a means to understand shading, to understand a non-mechanical approach, is subsumed into a mechanical set of approaches, right? And then is sort of attempted to be spread around the world as a system of a kind of sealed office building, air-conditioned, heated, ventilated, powered by fossil fuels, right? So this important kind of shift or arc or even kind of inversion almost of a kind of approach that is rooted in a kind of design method strategy. And is, you know, if you look through the book and the literally hundreds of images of these sort of diagrams and ideas about how to approach architecture and climate, the sort of design preoccupation becomes just kind of an engineering consultant's fee, in effect, right? I mean, and from this period in the 50s and 60s and all of the sort of debates of late and post and neo-modernism, in effect, right, that have occurred since are all sort of underwritten, so to speak, by just the assumption of air conditioning, right? The assumption of mechanical heating, the assumption of the engineers kind of figure that out once you produce your design. I mean, I'm speaking far too schematically, but that's the general thread. And so there's another kind of arc that plays out in the second part of the book is a sort of examination of how this question of air conditioning in particular really is also a sort of people conditioning, right? A sort of a setting up of a set of expectations. And this goes to your directly to this question of the norm and the universal, right? And this kind of sense of how we begin to understand that part of the project of architectural modernity as it developed in relationship to air conditioning and as it sort of spread around the world as the office tower and also the kind of suburban home and, you know, office park and mall and all sorts and airports, et cetera, many different, typologies and building ambitions relies on air conditioning, right? And just sort of spreads this kind of deep entrenched reliance on fossil fuels around the world at the same time. So it's also just to flag our challenge, right? That our challenge is in changing our ways of designing, of course, right? But also our own sort of conditioning, right? That we need to expect a different kind of thermal environment, right? As we move through the world. And certainly those of us, you know, in the industrialized, overcapitalized, emission of endless carbon emissions north, our job is to sort of reduce our comfort, right, and reduce our emissions and kind of live at the kind of edge of discomfort, I think, to kind of find a way to inhabit the world in different thermal terms. So there's a strong kind of imperative in the book that sets up a kind of project for thinking about life after carbon, right, which of course is where I'm taking the research in more recent essays, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. And I was actually very interested in the way you navigated between sort of individual architects and their relationship to various kinds of bureaucracy and the way in which that shaped their architecture in various ways. And then in turn, thinking about, our own relationship to various bureaucratic or sort of other norm-performing institutions that sort of fade into the background in ways that we don't quite understand, that we don't really sort of fully appreciate, I think, so that we think of things as being, this is the way they are, or this is the way they've always been. And we've sort of, acclimatized ourselves into this sort of, into a way of living that, as you really bring out in the book, has, it has a very short history, and that, what I really appreciate is the way you show in which this history is so contingent. In your response, you were talking about, this question of the relationship between comfort and discomfort. And there's this really sort of striking thing you say in the book, because, your book has this sense of urgency, and you talk about how the more comfortable we are, the more at risk we are as a species. And this is something that you talk very much about in the book. You also wrote this article for Log last year about, the importance in some ways of discomfort. I think I've seen some of you've talked about this on Twitter. Like, this is something that really, is very central to your work. And especially in light of the kind of, I think, racial reckoning that's been happening this year, I wondered if you could talk a little bit also about, kind of going a little further. You touch on this in the book, but I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this question, this relationship between comfort, the creation of comfort, and racial inequity. Because it felt like something that was particularly pertinent to talk about right now, we think of comfort as an ideal as humans, but you really, undo that idea I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous, and I appreciate. I mean, again, such a great question, and sort of engagement with the material, and really happy to have the opportunity to think that through. I think what I do in the book, and even also in the log article, as you note, is try to think about comfort as a sort of, in some sense, as a sort of form of capital, let's say, right, or a sort of operating as a sort of parallel set of kind of aspirational and oppressive systems, as does capital, which is to say, producing inequity, right, and so the comfort becomes a kind of index of how much you are immersed in a sort of set of which side of these this set of oppressive structures that you are on, and which is to say that comfort is an index in the sense of luxury, in the sense of in that sort of broad sense of the lack of sort of worrying about inconsistency, right? I mean even when you think about the sort of ways that we often, and who am I speaking of when I say we, right, of course, is immediately on the table. I mean, how do we imagine the sort of space of the interior as a space that's sort of charged with the sort of economic and racial and other sorts of social and environmental inequities, right? And in the same ways as the sort of fence line communities and other regions, sort of realms of environmental justice research, that help us to understand the quite explicitly racially and certainly economic stratifications that determine sites of development and spaces of toxicity and where the pollution, if you will, goes, right? And so really recognizing that the sort of broad sense of comfort, right, it's not just kind of 68 degrees or 70 degrees in your house, right, but it's just this sort of structural condition for a certain type of, in effect, racialized modernity, right? That says, kind of, those of us that can live in a certain type of acclimatized, sort of industrial produced, acclimatized space, that is a space of consistency, that is a space of productivity, that is a space of health and sort of management of economic systems. And I mean, I reflected on this at great length over this summer with some colleagues. I'm not sure if this is the part of the Twitter discussion you're referring to, but when it was very hot in Philadelphia, and the sort of, oh, it's too hot, I have to turn on my air conditioning, or oh, it's too hot, I can't get any work done. And this sort of sense of like, right, so let's not get any work done, right? I mean, let's, how do we sort of construct a notion of sort of comfort and a sort of sense even of sort of carbon reparations, right? That says that, those of us in Philadelphia and New York City in the August summer maybe need to sweat and stop working so that others can fill up we don't have any carbon budget left, but can, so that we're at least not contributing, right? Those of us who already have such privilege, right? I mean, in effect, obviously quite stratified across the Northeast, for example, in a hot, humid summer. But nonetheless, generally speaking, thinking very carefully about where we are directing our emissions, if you will, where we are allowing emissions to occur and where we are resisting them. And certainly the sort of, sealed white containers of upper class and middle class, largely white life in the city and in the condos, et cetera, and the office buildings that relate to them are spaces of immense carbon inequity, right? Of the production of carbon inequity and the sort of extent to which capital accumulation also becomes the accumulation of the sort of capacity for carbon emissions and how, what we're looking at is a broad, set of systemic disruptions that involves a kind of recognition of the racial injustices of the centuries, centuries long that we have to sort of reconcile across these climatic injustices, if you will, or sort of carbon extensions of these of social patterns, right, that have produced and intensified these different forms of inequity. I mean, I think a lot about, that certainly Acclimatization is a crucial aspect of contemporary life. I mean, when you think about hospitals in particular, when you think about vaccines that require negative 94 degree freezers, or where, I'm not sure if I have that number right, but you know, there's certainly many reasons to sharply acclimatize spaces for public health and individual well-being, social cohesion, et cetera. I mean, museum archives, right? I mean, there are valuable spaces that require acclimatization. The single family home, the office building is maybe not that space. This classroom even is maybe not that space, right? Where we can sort of operate differently in terms of our relationship to carbon, our relationship to comfort, and, you know, that intersection that says, you know, and of course this, I mean, we could play this out. This transforms dramatically in the pandemic age, shall we say, or almost post-pandemic age, if that's in fact where we are, but which is to say, you know, schools and ventilation and homes and air conditioning systems and the kind of relationship of viral contagion to HVAC is something else that comes into the equation. In wildly inequitable ways, right? And which is the sort of spaces of work of many of those in the BIPOC community who have been affected by COVID have often been poorly acclimatized or kind of ineffectively acclimatized, right, relative to the knowledge we have about how the virus moves in thermal interiors, right? So many challenges that emerge out of just sort of understanding this kind of intersection of air conditioning as a source of life and health, and that we can't avoid, right? But to be so sort of try to find a way to be so precise about how we kind of spend that carbon budget, right? And the inequities that we can heal through that process rather than increase and intensify. Right? I mean, I speak somewhat uncomfortably because I don't know that it's my place, but I think about a sort of sense of carbon or climate reparations, right, on a sort of global scale, right, that those of us who have benefited and built our lives around the assumption of a sort of carbon profligacy need to just stop, right, and you know, insofar as we can burn any carbon and emit any, you know, have any emissions, like that should be kind of concentrated in places that, you know, it thoughtfully allows others to have opportunities for fulfilling their lives, right, rather than, you know, making me less cold so I don't have to put on a sweater, or, you know, making, you know, sort of minimal adjustments to my own physical and physiological comfort that I can easily overcome in other fashion or through suffering, frankly, through being uncomfortable, right? It's fine with me. I'll be somewhat uncomfortable, right? And what is that limit, and how is it designed, and how is it imagined, and how does, you know, this become a sort of vision of a post-carbon future in which comfort, again, is this kind of index, right? Is this kind of space of politics, right? Is this space of negotiation as we imagine these futures and build them?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, there's something really sort of urgent that goes to that sort of runs through your whole book. You know, in your kind of discussion of acclimatization, not just of an interior environment, but also of humans themselves. But I think there's something in your text that I really hold on to, in that, you know, in your final chapter, you talk about the relationship between air conditioning and human conditioning. And there's a really nice play on words here, because it's not just, as you say, about, you know, conditioning as a form of creating comfort, but also conditioning or acclimatizing as a form of becoming adept. And that's something that I really hold on to as I, you know, read through this book and think about, you know, oh, this is where we are. And it is, we're in a really dire situation, but I think you put a lot of thought into your book in thinking about not only bringing us words of gloom and doom, but also thinking about, you know, charting different futures.
Yeah.
And there's something I really like about, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, precisely on the terms that you just described, I mean, that, you know, and a thread that I, you know, maybe didn't quite pick up on quite as much as I could have a moment ago in terms of the question of the norm and the universal, right? Which, I mean, it's kind of is a specter over much of what we've just been talking about. But relative to this question of adeptness and adaptability and, you know, kind of how we kind of imagine our future world, right? I mean, I think this, you know, which is in part to say that part of what's going on is in doing this research, I find that I'm learning from these practitioners in the 40s, 50s, and 60s how to kind of imagine an adaptable approach to, you know, kind of architecture as a set of social systems, right? And that becomes very tantalizing. So there's a kind of sense, a certain amount of optimism there, right? But one that is often crushed. I mean, it's kind of crushed every day, you know, in terms of the daily practice of being an architectural professor, an architecture professor, and involved in architectural pedagogy that has its high points and low points, let's say, relative to engagement with climate.
I think one thing you really do. I cut you off again. No, but I thought it was really interesting the way you kind of recuperate this sort of, you know, this what has been seen as a kind of countercultural or marginal idea of small being beautiful, or sort of, you know, the ways in which sort of a smaller footprint seems to be sort of marginal to, what we think of as mainstream architectural discourse. And you say, no, actually, let me sort of relook at some of people like Le Corbusier, who, you know, is this like sort of standard figure we look at in modern architecture, instead of saying, you know, there are different ways to look at this architecture that we've all been that we've all become really familiar with over time. And I also just want to draw attention to this other thing you do in the text. There's this little, you know, the way you end each chapter, there's a really interesting sort of, you know, you sort of end it with a little coda, or, you know, summary, or, you know, almost coming out of the text a little bit to talk to the reader. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your authorial decision to include those little notes almost at the end, where you sort of almost come out of the text to speak in a very sort of personal way to the reader.
No, and it's funny. I think that in some ways it's a kind of attempt to recognize the limitations of a given chapter, right? Which is to say that, you know, this is kind of what I was able to discuss coherently in the space, you know, allowed, and yet it's so much more, there's so much more to say, right? And I think a lot of those codas are really a combination of sort of just reflecting on, pulling in some threads and reflecting on the kind of connections that the, you know, for example, the Neutra, the discussion of Neutra and the discussion of the kind of American embassy building project, and how that sort of expands out into a broader sort of global interest in tropical architecture that, of course, has its own discourse and kind of parameters, and that has been written about at great length by many fabulous researchers and scholars and colleagues, right? And so, you know, wanting to sort of point to that work and sort of be aware of the limitations of, you know, this keeping this kind of thread coherent that allows us to have a story, but that also, you know, necessarily leaves out too much information. But that also, you know, again, always often kind of looks to the consequences, right? I mean, can, you know, how do we understand how the imaging practices that, you know, that I discuss in the fifth chapter of Victor and Aladar Ogyai, these, you know, diagrams and methodological drawings and the kind of, which is to say, not only the kind of Le Corbusiers and the architects we know, but the sort of more kind of niche subjects, the kind of individuals who, for whom this was kind of their conceptual realm, their kind of methodological world of thinking through climate and architecture, to really, you know, kind of understand their practices and their approaches. There was something I'm losing one part of the question. Sorry, there was something else I was going to bring in there, but
I was just talking about the sort of the end of the chapters, and just, you know, not just the content that you bring into the chapter, but your not just methodology also, but your way of writing was something that I was really interested in, especially with those, you know, the little notes that you include at the end.
I mean, it's, you know, I think there's another way to look at them that, I mean, I feel like they're also sort of possible dissertation projects. I feel like at the end of each chapter, I'm like, or you could go look at this, right? Or you could open up this archive. And you know, part of the goal of the book and certainly of the first book as well is just to kind of open this box onto architecture and environment. And again, I'm not trying to be too sort of boosterish, but this website Current that we've just put together, that's really trying to kind of capture this kind of broad sort of river that's now flowing of interest at the intersection of architecture, history, and environment. So I think there's also a kind of optimism, if you will, and I think that comes through in some of these codas, right? That's kind of, you know, there's lots of things we can look at to understand our relationship to the environment in different ways. Architecture is such a rich kind of, you know, vein to mine, to overplay a different metaphor than the river. But, you know, there's a lot of capacity here and there's a lot of interest. And so, you know, let's go, right? And let's try to figure this out. So I think that's part of the optimism too, that you were, you know, this is not just the doom and gloom, right? But that, you know, we've got to keep moving forward. And even though we know that it's that kind of notion of progressivism that has, you know, destroyed us in the past, basically, you know, we have to sort of find a way to work together to imagine a new way of life. And I think that, so I think in some ways those codas were maybe my kind of holding on to, you know, what could be, there could be very depressing consequences emerging from this discussion. And I should say there also are, but I think that, yeah, there's maybe almost a kind of necessity to reassert at every, you know, every possible, at every conclusion, right? That there's hope to be found in these, in the imagination, in our ways of working, in our capacities to work together, right? So, I don't know that I really say that a lot explicitly. I feel like I do a bit at the very end, but I think I appreciate that you sense the kind of hints that emerge at the end of each chapter that start to try to kind of open up, I hope, sort of building on each other to kind of, you know, say, what sort of possibilities does this allow? How can we now think differently now that we, you know, how does this help, right? And how does it intersect with other scholarship and other architects and other buildings and other ideas that can help us, you know, kind of think differently about the world that we face? Because that's the urgency, right? It's maybe goes without saying, but the kind of conceptual struggle, if you will, or the kind of epistemological challenge is the challenge at stake in thinking about, in my mind, and kind of thinking about climate change and architecture and more generally. You know, we have the tools, we have the technologies, the methods. This is also demonstrated, right? I mean, it's just sort of almost kind of obvious in you know, I think there's 425 images or something like that, right? I mean, there's just this sort of mountain of evidence that says, you know, look at how dynamic this discussion has been. And then again, these codas are almost like, and this is just a slice of it, right? I mean, this is just, I'm just opening, I'm just peeking. You know, there's a whole world of discourse around architecture and climate that is to be excavated by, you know, myself and others, future scholars. I mean, this is, again, a huge realm of historical and historiographic analysis, right? So to really celebrate that, right, and see it as a sort of, yeah, imperative to kind of look through this, not only do the research, but to think about how these different imperatives and these different methods and these kind of questions of applied history and the relationship of historical knowledge to contemporary practices also opens up kind of different approaches to research, right, not just in terms of kind of archives, but also method, of course. So that's a big part. You know, we discussed I chair the PhD program at the University of Pennsylvania. That's you know, we talk a lot about method. We think a lot about how our architectural research methods adjusting and thinking differently in relationship to, you know, the changing contours of the world that is, you know, that it's a part of. And again, the questions of racial equity and inequity and gendered spaces. And I mean, these are you know, the themes that we bring into the discourse and also produce in students and research and, you know, in exhibitions, et cetera, and projects. So trying to find some solace in the rich vein of possibility that's sort of endemic to research, right? I mean, researching is such a practice of discovery. So holding on to that in some fundamental way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really love how, you know, in the book you talk about, you know, your book is filled with tons of images, and you talk about the power of these images to spur specific actions. And, you know, you've been talking in this podcast about how you yourself want your book and sort of the work that you do to kind of spur people towards particular kinds of actions that, you know, make us think a little bit more about discomfort as a way of being, not just comfort. Instead of, you know, what does acclimatizing mean for us right now? And I realize I've taken up a lot of your time. So I just wanted to ask, you know, in closing, what's next for you? And perhaps, you know, in writing this book, I wanted to ask a little bit about not just what's next, but how this book has maybe changed, not just in terms of what content you knew, but even kind of methodologically or, you know, a way of thinking that may have sort of emerged out of this that you might be taking with you into your future projects.
Yeah, fabulous. And again, thanks so much for this opportunity in general. It's been a great discussion. And you know, and I think that it kind of also brings up threads that we've been playing out. I mean, in many ways, you know, the book came out in July, I think, officially, right? So I'm mm-hmm. really at a moment when, you know, of sort of such kind of optimism and terror in terms of the kind of righteous unrest on the streets and the kind of panics of the pandemic and, of course, the, you know, continuing demise of our democracy. And so there's, I think there's a, you know, there's a sense that, you know, as we've been discussing that part of what's on the table is to think about these issues, both in their kind of contemporary urgency, but in particular in relationship to questions of racial justice and sort of climate justice broadly considered, insofar, you know, and teasing out some of those questions vis-a-vis the Green New Deal, vis-a-vis other sorts of discourses in architecture and landscape and amongst colleagues near and far, and another sort of set of intersections around the pandemic, right? And so, which is to say that the kind of, insofar as I've tried to kind of conceptualize the thermal interior as a space of politics, right? That's become increasingly it's heating up, I guess I would say, right? I mean, there's pressurized, or there's even more kind of going on in there, or at least there's opportunities to discuss some of these issues in new and compelling and dynamic ways that I'm happy to have the chance to sort of embrace and work with. So I'm doing a couple of projects that are, you know, thinking about, you know, I won't get into them in too creative a length, but I'm writing a kind of small book on the history and theory of the emergency exit. That's kind of an attempt to see emergency exits as a kind of structural model. There's a brief article appeared on eFlux some about a year and a half ago, but to kind of think about the emergency exit as a kind of structuring condition of the city, right? The something that we can get out of, right? And also how that kind of becomes a structuring condition of capital and investment and risk analysis and sort of built environment more generally, and a sort of model of, you know, how we kind of are frankly relating to climate and pandemics and other sorts of sort of global cataclysms that we, you know, the vaccine becomes this sort of emergency exit, right? We sort of assume and sometimes produce, right, some escape route to some extent. Of course, I won't get into the whole details of the vaccine and how long it may take to be effective, et cetera, but, you know, the sort of model for contemporary risk society, right, to play off of Ulrich Beck's, of course, famous phrase. That's very reliant on a way out, and the challenge that climate disruption presents to those conceptual frames. And it's, you know, I just spoke about it on that very sort of, I'm somewhat abstract, right, conceptual way, but it's really a book that's kind of documenting and kind of looking at these emergency exits and how they've been conceptualized and produced and designed and built. I'm doing another project on stranded assets, which looks at, you know, in a sense, this is a broader project that has an exhibition component, a pedagogical component, that tries to understand how we will kind of use, you know, sealed curtain wall, you know, Seagram's Tower type of buildings after the fall, right? After carbon is no longer socially viable. Which is to say today, but once, you know, once that hits us finally, right, how will these buildings exist, right? So there's a kind of attempt to recover or see this. It's really indeed a space just to imagine these possible futures and to get into a sort of visual and mediatic dialogue with the kind of histories and stories and narratives and possible futures relative to energy and life and buildings, basically. And then I'm also a third book that's called Thermal Practice, that's more sort of interview based and talking to architects and engineers and kind of just trying to understand in more detail how that kind of thermal interior is conceptualized today as a kind of space for climatic transformation, right? A space for sort of cultural transformation. So I don't know, I dare say a bit more of a sort of popular book, if you will, than rather than an academic object, scholarly object that will sort of bring, you know, my perspective and the knowledge of many of my colleagues and others, hopefully to a sort of broader reading public. So we'll see. Yeah, lots of irons in the fire, if you will. But, you know, of course, all I've been doing lately is kind of managing the turmoil of Zoom teaching and homeschooling, and I haven't done anything of substance on any of those projects for a few months, but I'm looking forward to getting back to them.
Yeah, sounds like you have a lot on your plate. But yes, also with the pandemic, it does seem like everyone has much more on their plate, or just has to adapt much more than usual.
No, of course. Yes, it was such a pleasure, and really appreciate your engagement with the book and the invitation. And thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. This was an incredibly fabulous discussion. So thank you for taking the time to talk about your book with me and this discussion of Modern Architecture and Climate, Design Before Air Conditioning by Daniel E. Barber, published by Princeton University Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in Architecture channel of the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.